Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 6th, 2014, and welcome to episode 78 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Find my way back to Oz. Will I ever find my way back to
Oz? The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, playing around, wasting as much time as we possibly can while maximizing the amount of fun. Wouldn't you guys say? And so, without further ado, because we all hate ado, I'm going to start going around the table and introducing us, our first contestant, from Toronto, Ontario. He's 5'9", weighing in at 140 pounds, soaking wet.
You have me shrinking in all directions.
Hello, Carrington.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fantastic. And well, smaller today. By the recording, it seems. The incredible shrinking Carrington.
It's amazing what we can do on the podcast. So none of you listeners get cocky with us. We'll like shrink you right down. Paul, what's going on your end?
It's my first day with my newly reconditioned hard drive, having experienced a bit of a hard drive failure over the last couple of days. And that's what I've been doing.
You had a computer glitch?
Yeah, surprisingly. Computers actually usually make life easier, but not always. So anyway, I've been doing some retro stuff and, definitely some sort of archaeological stuff in my modern computing world.
But you're recovered.
I am recovered. Yes. I'm recording this now on that machine.
So I imagine it wasn't malware. So what was it?
Well, people advise you to leave some space on your hard drive. Don't fill it all the way up. And I feed.
It turns out to be a good idea.
Yeah. Essentially, I just lost the directory structure, and that was it.
But gotcha. It's a good thing you had backups.
Yes. Yes. Time Machine did a very good job. Actually, this is an Apple, MacBook. It took a long time, but it's pretty much just back the way it was. So anyway, not interesting to retro computing listeners, but nevertheless, I am impressed.
Excellent. Well, so Michael, has your computer gone south recently?
Not the one that
I'm
using.
Actually, you're all the way south yourself, so I guess I can't use that
map. I am all the way south, but no, my computers are working fine, but this PC beside me, the hard drive in it, is doing clunk, clunk, shudder, clunk, clunk, clunk noises. So I think it's caught what Paul's computer had.
Well, that's a very bad thing. You were asking on chat if your hard drive should be making those sounds, and I can tell you it should not. So,
I've already got a service call in on it, so the text should be in to replace it with something less old this week.
I think replacing it with something with a solid state drive that gives you absolutely no warning at all that it's going to fail.
This is the RCR. You're supposed to replace it with something more old.
Yeah, yes, this is my work computer, so I definitely won't be replaced with an SSD. I can tell you that.
I think an ST251. Would be, because that's, what was it, 40 megabytes of raw power.
Who'd need 40 megabytes of storage?
I know. A Congress. Well, so now that we're all bellied up to the round table, I guess we ought to talk about something retro-y. So I'm going to lead out with our typical host topic. And this time I've chosen preserving the wild retroelope. What can we do
to keep these rare things from becoming more rare. So recreations are great. We love the recreations that are coming out from companies like Brio Computers and others. And repairs are great. As we've seen in the Retro Challenge and other places, it's very cool when you can fix these things as opposed to just trade them out. But I've started to wonder, what can we do to make sure that the vintage computers don't fail in the first place? What can we spray them with? You know, what kind of super type of substance can we encase them with to make sure that they just don't fail in the first place? And I'm not just talking about the computers, but also the peripherals and the media. So a few points I'll throw out there just to kind of get the discussion going, and then we can go around the table and see what you guys think. For one thing, replacements are just going to get more scarce as time goes on. We're not going to have spares, and we know that. We've talked about that, I think, ad infinitum here on the show. But what does that mean? It means that we ought to take care of what we got. So a while back, I had one of my portable Commodore 64 computers, the SX 64, reconditioned. And during that process, the folks who were fixing it up for me put some heat sinks on some of the chips that tend to run more hot on the Commodore systems. And I know that, for instance, with the Apples, what do they call those things? The Apple crates? The things that go over the top and have a little fan so it gets some airflow going over the chips?
It's the System Saver, I think you're...
Yeah, it's the System Saver.
System Saver. Okay. So those things are good and help to keep the chips living longer. I also posted something over on the vintage computer forums about floppy disks, because we know they're going bad, they're rotting out, but we know also that there's tons of floppy disks that are sitting on a shelf. I can't remember the name of the one company that has a couple truckloads full of the old 5 1/4 double-sided double density. And the people who have bought from this company have had really good luck. They say the oxide isn't scraping off. The disks appear to have been stored well. But we know that it's just a matter of time with those disks too. So I posted something saying, like literally, chemically, mechanically, is there anything that we can do to these floppy disks to keep them from failing 5 or 10 years down the line? And unfortunately, on that discussion thread, I didn't get much interest in the idea. People were just saying, well, have you had problems with them? And I was saying, no, that's not the point. The point, well, kind of the point is exactly that I haven't had problems with the brand new ones, but we know that we will. So what can we do with the brand new ones to make sure that they don't go bad? So that kind of thing. So let me switch it backwards of the introductions here and start with Michael. Michael, what can we do to keep these things cooking longer?
Well, we could just turn them off, put them in a box, and stop using them. But that wouldn't be fun.
You know, the irony is that might not even work, because people say that they have shelf rot, that you put the old computers on the shelf. Tez is always talking about that. He's saying that...
yeah, you've got to take them out and give them some exercise is basically what he's saying. But
well, I think Tez's rule is the likelihood that something will fail is proportional to the amount of time it's sat on a shelf plus how urgent it is that you use it right now. I think that may be true of computers in general.
There's lots of old wives' tales or husband's tales, whatever you want to call it, of leaving them powered on, not turning them off, leaving them on the shelf. It's just so many bits and pieces out there that it's all confusing to me. So I'm still quite lucky, I suppose. I want to use my old computers. I plug them in, turn them on, and so far no one has let me down. So whether it's my Apple II or VZ200 or any of my other computers, so far everyone who I have acquired working still is, and those computers which I've repaired and got working haven't failed me yet. So I'll touch wood on this one, and I'll just keep using them.
Excellent.
The usual things with media storage, just keeping it well. I suppose I've never stored any of my computers or media or peripherals in a hostile environment out in the back shed or anything like that. They've always been inside the house, either in the spare room or in the section of the house that I use for working on. So everything's kept in good condition once it gets into my place. So environmentally, I think I'm okay. I've seen people's computers where they have literally kept them out in the back shed. They haven't been sealed well. The dust gets in. The creatures get in. It's amazing what a couple of cockroaches shorting themselves out across your power supply is going to do.
That's a very good point, though. Environmentally, if we can keep the computers from wild temperature extremes, humidity extremes, that kind of thing, like keeping the disks in a cool, dry sort of storage environment. I didn't even think about that as I was putting together these notes. But
I've seen floppy disks that have actually had mold growing on them. None of mine, but you have someone's place and they say, these disks aren't working. And you have a look at it and people talk about disk rot, but I'm sure having mold and mildew growing on the disk platter itself of the floppy disk is not good. Definitely not good for the heads as it's spinning around. You don't really want to be using your drive heads as a method of cleaning the floppy disk. But long-term storage, I strongly recommend either bagging your computer or putting it into a storage box so that at least you're keeping it away from moisture, maybe throwing some sachets of silica. What's the little granules you get in all your pack, all those computers, electronics these days?
Oh, right, the little do-not-eat packets.
Desiccant, yeah. That was on my list as well, desiccant.
Yeah, so, I've seen people making great walls of computers. No, don't do that. Something's going to go awry. So storage boxes, get it in there, the computer in there with all its peripherals, all its cables, power supplies. Not only does it help keep the computer in better long-term condition, you're actually keeping all your bits and pieces together with it so that it's easier to get it up and running. So a little bit of environmental, a little bit of storage, and what the heck, just keep using them.
And I think that you are more likely to use them if they're well organized like that. I have a lot of my vintage computers in stackable Rubbermaid tubs. So they're somewhat sealed. I mean, it's not hermetically sealed, but they have a fairly good seal. Nothing's going to get in there. And they're kept in the house in the closet. And if I want to use one, I just go through the tubs until I get to the one that I want in the stack. And I take it out and I use it. So... awesome. Well, Paul, what thoughts do you have about this?
Well, I know I have seen some of these discs with mold on them, and it does happen.
Is it supposed to be green and fuzzy? Are my floppy disks supposed to be green and fuzzy? I don't think so.
Commodore discs.
Yeah. Hey now.
For some reason, there's a I've always had this. There's a Dilbert cartoon that has stuck in my head, which for forever, which was essentially I don't know the characters' names even, but the Wally, I think, is one of the characters. Says isn't it sort of in principle? I think isn't it in principle basically the case that in theory the towel. That I am the cleanest thing in the house after taking a shower. That's it. So why should I have to wash a towel? Right. So the thing goes on a little bit and sort of like the closing quote is, while I sort of pondering, are towels supposed to bend? Anyway, whatever. So for some reason, this is not an interesting story, but this reminded me of it. So I guess.
Well, floppy disks are not supposed to bend. I can tell you that. At your own risk.
Right, you don't want to fold them up in your pocket.
But if they are green and fuzzy, bend them all you want. Fold them, use them as frisbees, because they're not going to be good for anything else at that point.
It's not easy being green.
I think actually I've had some success with alcohol, just sort of... It actually took me to get through the window.
Success with alcohol.
I was going to say that's a novel use of alcohol. Right. I normally take it internally.
Right. At any rate, the if you can sort of wipe down the media, and it's, you have to not wipe too hard or the actual magnetic stuff comes off. But I have gotten a moldy disc to go from, you know, not reading to reading okay, doing that. So that's sort of useful. One of the things that occurs to me in this whole storage discussion is that it's interesting how, you know, now that we're 30 years on or whatever, looking at how things were stored, things that people thought were safe aren't. So one of the main thing that I'm thinking of now is there used to be these disc binders. Apple had binders, and you could get plastic pages where you put the discs in the slots, usually outside. Usually you take them out of the sleeve and put them in this little, like, it's a three ring binder page. But the problem is that the plastic leaks oil. So anyone who's, you know, so I've wound up with a couple of these binders where, you know, they're full of really quite interesting discs, and they're all greasy. You know, the labels are all soaked and transparent, and, you know, you really have to kind of work at it to not destroy the drive head when you're trying to get the data off of them. But so that's one of the things that, you know, I'm sure the idea was that this was a safe place to put the discs. But in fact, actually, discs that have been stood up in boxes, you know, in a dry space in their sleeves, actually survived much more, much better. So,
well, it's hard to know, like you say, what's going to be safe 20, 30 years from now. A lot of the photographs that I have from my youth were stored in those old photo albums where you just put the plastic page right over the top of the photographs. And of course, now looking at it 30, 40 years later, the photographs are partially ruined because of that. And my wife's into scrapbooking and can tell you there are papers that are acid-free and have other chemical characteristics that tend to keep the photos a lot safer. And in those conditions, they'll probably last decades and decades. But yeah, we just didn't know back then. And also, probably no one thought that we'd want to be reading these things 30 years later.
True. But I guess the other thing, too, as far as just like what to do with the computer to sort of make it last, the obvious thing is capacitors, you know, particularly the littler ones. And there's that era, I don't know, it was sort of late 80s, early 90s era in Apple, at least. But I think in a lot of computers, definitely all the Macs and the Nexts had capacitors that leak. So if you you know, they're going to go bad if they haven't yet, and replacing those is something that you could do preventatively. But you know, as it doesn't seem to me like it's worth trying to figure out how to rehabilitate an actually old capacitor in order to use an original part. I think that just going ahead and using a new one is probably a much better idea.
Well, I don't think you can rehabilitate. Thanks for using a big word and tripping me up. The little capacitors, but I think some of the huge capacitors that you used to find in the linear power supplies, I've talked to people about this in the S100 realm. It is cheaper and better probably to go get some switching power supplies, which provide cleaner power. And of course, they're much smaller and lighter. But if you want to make those old linear power supplies work, you can do some electrical tricks that will make them reform the chemical components that are inside the capacitor. I don't pretend to 100% understand it, but if you do it correctly, you can actually get the capacitor to rejuvenate itself. And some of those extremely large electrolytics are very expensive if you go to buy a new one. So in those cases, it might be worth it. But you're right, with the little ones, just replace them with something better. I think another thing along that same line is perhaps preemptively replacing NiCad batteries. If you've got some of the old portables like the Model 100 or the Epson PX8 or even some of the smaller calculators that spoke basic but have a little kind of a memory battery on the circuit board, those things
can... CR2032s, yeah.
Yeah, those things can go bad and leak across the printed circuit board and goof you up as well.
As can parameter batteries, like on the 2GS and stuff. It's very easy to swap those for some an external separate little battery in its own little connector that you then wire back to the board, and then that stops that from just leaking all over your motherboard in the future. Replace the batteries and fear the batteries is the message.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have there's a number of projects, battery replacement projects that I have. The Mac Portable needs a battery. It actually needs a battery to start. Like it once the battery dies, the computer won't start even plugged in.
Well, it's the Mac Portable actually, as you said, it runs off the battery. All the mains is doing is charging the battery. So if there's no good battery in there, there is no power connection.
Right. And the Epson PX8 is like that as well. It does not like to run without its main battery working, even if you plug it in.
So, and there's those, what are they called? The Lexicon. I've forgotten the name. LK3000. I have a whole bunch of these things, but they're all a little like rechargeable calculator sized things. And I'm probably like 80% of the ones that I've opened up have had really, you know, lousy corrosion on the batteries. And I guess the point I was trying to get to was that I think I would like to know what is required to actually replace these batteries, like, because there is some kind of recharging circuit. I don't think just anything in there will work. You know, I think that there is something you have to match, but I don't know what that is. So that's one of my own sort of like knowledge acquisition projects, and for the future is to try to figure out what kind of battery, modern battery, if possible, that I can use to replace the batteries that are either gone or going.
The battery packs that I've replaced, I've actually just replaced them with Leica. So you can actually still buy new NiCad batteries. I know NiCads aren't as good as what else is available. But as you said, a lot of those battery packs that you put into your old laptops have a charging circuit, little bit of circuitry in there. So I think that from my point of view, the safest thing to do is to just replace the cells. And if you can put cells in there that have a greater capacity, then at least you'll have a reconditioned battery pack and a longer running time on the laptop. Normally, to me, the biggest challenge is cracking open the battery shell itself, because they were intentionally designed not to be replaceable. So now they're one-way clips, or they've got a glue or something in there. So normally I'm there with a fine blade on my Dremel mounted on the desk, and I'm just running slowly around the join edge of the battery until
it's open. Do you feel like a James Bond villain while you're doing that? No, Mr. Battery, I expect you to charge.
Yes. I even have the fluffy cat that I can stroke while I'm gloating at the fate of it as the circular saw comes down towards it.
Very good. So I've got a couple things to add as well. You guys have taken all my best thoughts. Screw you all. That sucks for going last. So I do agree. We were talking about before about wrapping things up, and I had specifically noted that a good material to use, if you're going to wrap things, my go-to wrapping material is glassine, which is sort of like wax paper is what it feels like. The nice thing about glassine is you can get it. It's pH neutral. It's acid free. It won't react with anything, even paper, over any amount of time. So it's the nice, simple, if you're not sure what to wrap something in, wrap it in glassine. It will never adhere to anything, and it'll never react with anything over like a 300-year period. So I'll typically wrap stuff in glassine and then just wrap around that with, say, just a saran wrap or some sort of cling film, and that can keep everything nicely together and keep it from interacting with anything else. I'll generally completely separately wrap or usually bag anything that can be food for mold. So if you're going to put your stuff away, things like cloth and things like paper and all your documents should be separate, or if they're going to be in a tub together, make sure they're separately bagged, because those will be your mold starting points that will then spread to everything else in that Rubbermaid tin or Rubbermaid bin. If you've got mold in there, it doesn't help. So you want to separate those things. Desiccant, like we talked about, satchels of desiccant should go inside everything else. I'll generally, before I store things away, I'll clean all the contacts, but don't do the lazy thing we all do, which is clean them with a pencil eraser, because it leaves residue. So that's the lazy. You should generally clean your contacts with cloth or just basically plain cardboard. I just use business cards to clean contacts, and cleans them nice and doesn't leave any residue if you're trying to think about storing things. Storing during use is also important. If you're going to have stuff on your desk and you don't use it that often, then trying to just keep it relatively like dust-free can really help, because it's not just your, like we were talking about, it's the capacitors for power supplies, those things go bad. But it's also your lights and your fans seem to be the things that get messed up. And often they seem to get messed up just because of junk that gets inside there. So I used to make fun of people that use dust covers on their computers back in the day. But it's probably a good thing for those computers that have now survived. So that's a good way to go. Another thing, I guess last tip, is if I'm storing stuff, I check that it's working. Like I say, okay, look, this is currently a working thing, and I've checked everything, and everything seems fine. When I put it away, I try to put away a complete set. So it's going to have any cables needed. It's going to have bootstrap media. Like, when you turn this on, what is the disk I'm going to want to have with it to turn it back on? And any manuals, and those are all stored together. I'll separately bag the manuals. I separately bag any paper products, again, to keep my mold contained. But at least in an ideal world, if I open up the bin that it's stored in, this is a self-contained playpen of, you know, this computer. And finally, when I am storing things, I try to think in terms of, I'm standing here with a hose and I'm spraying like crazy. And if you can think that your stuff will survive that, then you'll survive things like floods, etc. Because you box everything, you throw it in your basement, you forget about it. 5 years from now, there's a leak and everything's destroyed. So the Rubbermaid bins, or those plastic bins, they might not perfectly seal them, but at least they bob and they float and we'll save. And if not that, then at least get like skids, which you can get for free. Get skids or pallets. Throw those in your basement and store everything 5 or 6 inches off the ground. It gives you at least an emergency time to be grabbing stuff. So those would be the tips I have. And finally, there's while you guys were talking, I was trying to research for more things, and I found a really good online PDF. There's I guess it's an article. I don't know what this is called. Preserving Computers Past. It's by Maxwell Burnett and Robert Supnick. So Preserving Computers Past, Restoration and Simulation. So it talks specifically about old tech, things like PDP-11s. How do you restore it? How do you restore them after being stored? What are the mistakes people make when they store them? How to, like a whole bunch of details. And then it even goes through like little tips, like what are the things that will go wrong on a computer and what to look at before you store it, what to look at before you turn it on if it hasn't been used for a long time. And then it goes down to like a big case study at the bottom and but specific stuff. So it's actually really good. Seems to have been published in 1996 in something called the Digital Technical Journal. And reading it while you guys were talking, I actually learned a whole bunch of things. So I would recommend that. We'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, just one parting note with since mold keeps coming up on this. I don't use a bleach or similar for killing the mold because in most cases it doesn't. What I use is a couple of drops of oil of cloves in some warm water and then just a strong paper towel or a clean cotton cloth dipped in that, wrung out, and then just wipe over whatever it is that has got the mold or has been near something with mold on it, because the oil of cloves kills the spores, unlike bleaches, which basically just makes it all disappear but not necessarily kill it. So eliminate, exterminate.
Fascinating. I think that these things have been good enough. I'm tempted to go back over this episode and make a blog post about the various things we've talked about, because I think they're all really potentially very helpful. We'd probably have to have a disclaimer in there warning use of these techniques doesn't guarantee that you won't destroy all your stuff. But if you want to keep your stuff, if you want to keep your stuff working, here's some possible ways to do it. It's been a great conversation. Thank you, guys. Paul, speaking of preserving, you have some anecdotes about disk imaging.
Yeah. So normally I kind of like browse around the web and try to find, you know, interesting stories. And of course, my hard drive crashed during that research time. So what I'm going to do instead is sort of talk about what I've been working on. So I have a hardware card for the Apple II. I may have mentioned this before. It's the Essential Data Duplicator card. And it was a hardware solution to copying disks that were protected. So what I've been doing is I've been spending some time kind of trying to make disk images of these disks that I have, various things, just for preservation purposes. And so There's a program that Brutal Deluxe has created called I'm Fed Up, which allows you to use, I think they used, it's actually built from the source code of, now I've forgotten who's responsible for the EDD software originally, but it's built from the same source that the original copy program was, but it's in a slightly more, you know, modern environment such that it can use large, it can save files to complex flash devices and so forth. And so, but what it does, there's a couple things that I wanted to say about it. So one of the things is that it, when you're reading an Apple II disk, there's a couple of different disk images. And I'm sure this is true for other platforms as well. I'm not like the Commodore 64 and so forth. I actually have not had as much experience with the others, but the Apple II, when it's accessing the disk, as actually it will control the drive sort of with the processor. It's all software. One of the ways that the Apple II was made cheap was by sort of taking all of the smarts out of the drive and having the drive controller run it all. But so one of the things that this means is that basically the copy protection industry figured out ways that they could, you know, make the drive do tricks through software. So one of the things that they could do is move things in half and quarter tracks even. So sometimes they would write the data not on the tracks you'd expect, but on the intermediate ones. And the thing that the EDD card is useful for, which is, you know, finally getting to the point, is that it also just, and I guess I can't get too deep into the logic of it, but the data that's on the disk is basically just a stream of zeros and ones, and the controller card has a way of taking those zeros and ones and turning them into, it turns them into basically five or six bit bytes, and then feeds them into the software. And one of the things that the protection people did was to sort of vary the timing of these, these nibbles, they're called, as they come along. And so just basically because the hardware processes all this information on the disk prior to, you know, something sort of accessing it from the computer side, there's some of this timing information cannot be recovered from the Apple II side if you're just making a copy. So that what the EDD card does is basically records all of the bits that are coming off the disk before they actually hit the processing card. So what I've been doing is basically using this bitstream. I've written a couple of scripts that will take this bitstream and try to interpret it, try to emulate the controller card in order to attempt to get some kind of even lower level disk image format that could be used to copy protected disks, and I hope someday, you know, get them into an emulator that can actually read them. So it's been a pretty interesting project. There's a kind of a similar thing that's going on with the Disk Ferret as well. The Disk Ferret is one of the it's one of those flux readers, so it also will provide a stream of a data stream that you need to break into pieces that are sort of recognizably bits and nibbles, and you have to sync everything together. And it's actually an interesting and complicated problem, but I've gotten to the point where I can take that bit stream and say, you know, I'm on track zero, sector six, and it's got a bad epilogue byte. And, you know, I've got a converter that will take simple unprotected bit streams into regular disk images and things. And so, that's been an interesting interesting project, and it's interesting to get that deep into, you know, kind of like how the disks work. The other sort of like side point that I put here was that I also managed to get a hold of it's called a rocket chip accelerator, which is very cool. It takes the Apple II to 10 megahertz, which is unbelievable. But it actually has made this imaging process much, much faster, because it just reads the track and then almost immediately does all the processing and writes it out to the image file. So things that used to take something like 25 minutes, you know, it would take about that long to do a single disk. It actually did bring it down to something like, I think it's done in four. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's really useful. Anyway, so that's my anecdote about disk imaging. And hopefully I'll have, this would have been my retro challenge project, except that I'm just, I haven't gotten to write anything up, so I'll just do it anyway.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I'd be fascinated to see some of the details on this. And I think, again, as these floppy disks get further in their lifetime, understanding not just how they worked, but the ways to potentially fix them if there's something wrong with the media that you've got, it's just going to get more and more important. So very cool. I'm glad that there's people out there on the front lines like you that are doing this stuff. Yep. So, Carrington, instructional videos about the Altair 8800, surely this is from back in the 70s, right? On VHS tape?
But you know what? That would be so much cooler. But these are still pretty neat. So
they are cool.
There's a stumbled on this, I think through Reddit or somebody. Somebody linked to it recently. There's a whole bunch of Altair 8800 instructional videos. So just a video showing an Altair. And it goes through, like, here's the front panel. Here's the new programming. Videos on loading different games and playing them. Videos on, like, floppy stuff. Just a whole bunch of stuff. And I found them really fascinating. So I've been working my way through them. There's, I think, around 30 of them or so, all by the same fellow. I'm pretty sure that fellow is Mike Douglas, who's the guy who did the Altair 8800 clone. So I'll link to that as well, which is altairclone.com. And I think it's the same person. And if not, then I apologize. But I'm pretty sure this is the same person. And great video. So these are not videos from back, you know, back in the 30, 40 years ago when this was new. They're modern videos, but it's still, like, really, I mean, it brought back a ton of memories for me. Just really, really fascinating. So we're linked to the, over on YouTube is a playlist, and you can sort of then view them all and jump around or pick which ones you want or what have you. And then we'll also link over to the Altair 8800 clone site in case you would like to pick up one yourself that you could then play around with. I think they retail for, yeah, $621. So you can get yourself either a kit or a fully assembled one, same price either way. And I think it's $50 to add a audio cassette interface, that sort of thing. So super fun. If you're into the Altair, you can pick yourself up a clone and you can use these videos to teach yourself all that retro goodness.
And this kind of stuff is really great for showing off how the thing worked at a very detailed level. I mean, sometimes on YouTube you get these videos like, here's my retro computer and here it's playing this game or here it's doing this other thing. And those things are fascinating. But this is really in depth. Like, these switches do this, and this is what these lights are for.
Yeah, they're really good detail. Like, it's like, here's 10 minutes on how we load a program on paper tape, and it's all the details. And so it's not just, like, a lot of these videos are, you know, 10, 15 minutes long, and they're about one very specific thing, so which is nice.
Yeah, it was beautiful and done in good quality, too.
Yeah, so I was really impressed.
So, Michael, going even more retro with a capital R, what about the EDSAC?
EDSAC, that's the Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator. Just love those acronyms. I have a bit of a real love of reading about all of the first computers that were basically being built after World War II. And what we have here with EDSAC is that it's a computer that was built just after World War II at Cambridge University, and then decommissioned and broken up. And it, of that day, it was the only model, the only one of that type. Now, it was a custom-built, general-purpose computer, just not something off the shelf. So what's currently on through the National Museum of Computing is that they're rebuilding EDSAC, and basically they don't have all of the circuit diagrams. They have very few of the circuit diagrams. They have pictures of the components and assemblies, but not all of the pictures have detailed date information with them, so they don't know if they were early prototypes or part of the operational computer. But what happened recently is that 19 large circuit diagrams were recovered and donated in to the team. It's a bit of an interesting back history on it. John Loger, who bought these diagrams in, basically said that he was an engineer in the maths lab in 1959, just after EDSAC had been decommissioned, and was walking down a corridor, and there's a pile of stuff getting ready to be thrown out. Now, so many times we've heard stories of old computer-related material basically just getting piled up, ready to throw out, and then something caught his eye. It was a roll of circuit diagrams for EDSAC. He said it was a bit of a collector, so he couldn't couldn't resist the urge to rescue them, and that was back in 59. Recently visited the National Museum of Computing and learned about the project to rebuild the EDSAC, and he went home, retrieved the circuit diagrams and gave them to the project team. And that basically allowed them to fill in some missing holes of what they were trying to recreate. So as well as the link to the newsletter storage at Cambridge Network on finding those EDSAC diagrams, we also have links to the actual EDSAC replica project, which there's also video and everything in there. So one of the first general purpose computers, as opposed to something that was being specifically built for a specific task. So this is the start of a computer where you created the program to actually run on it. And it's basically a beautiful piece of old tech, I would say. You know, you got your metal cabinets and racking, valves everywhere. It is beauty. This is my idea of big metal. So it never hurts to pack that stuff away. One day someone might find something that you grabbed 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago might actually be useful sometime in the future. But it's another one of these interesting recreation projects. So I strongly recommend going over there just to have a look at some of the history of retro computing.
And to look at some of the photos of the EDSAC. I love big computing. And this, yeah, which basically just looks like it looks like these cabinets that are just shelves of tubes. It looks like it's, yep, like you look at the computer, you're like, is this a store that sells vacuum tubes? Because it just looks like shelves of tubes to me. Totally awesome.
It really is cool. And, you know, Michael, you yourself have said we don't really need an excuse for a retro computing hobby or being pack rats in some cases. We just do it because we enjoy it. But if you did need an excuse, like when things like this come up, it's just unbelievable. So, so very,
makes
very
you
cool.
Think, yeah, makes you think what else was in that corridor that was going to be tossed out. Well, did get tossed out, that didn't get rescued, and in hindsight should have gone into a archive. As we've said in the past, I think it was you, Earl, last week, it's normally the individual enthusiast that holds a lot of the historical information and our computing heritage, not necessarily the large institutional museums and archives.
And there was an outfit in Colorado that was selling PX8 laptop computers, and they also had a box of just random stuff, a few components and a bunch of disks. And they asked me, would you like to have this? And they quoted me a price, and I thought it was very reasonable. So I bought it. When I got it, it had lots of software for the PX8. And even though there are a couple of FTP sites, I'm not sure that software is actually represented anywhere. So I haven't had a chance yet to catalog all of it, but I was just thinking, you know, it's possible that some of the stuff that I got isn't anywhere other than in my collection. I'd use some software to allow me to pull it onto a modern computer where I've got it stored, and I've even got a copy of it out in cloud storage. But yeah, sometimes these things that you never know what's going to be important. I mean, I'm thinking everything that I got is trivial. The world would probably just go on fine without it. But goodness, you never know. So, and so speaking of other things that people kept, I have a video that Scott sent me, one of our listeners, for, and I think it's mistitled. It's up on YouTube. And they say it's Seymour Cray's only surviving talk. an introduction to the Cray 1 from 1976. And I don't think that's true. I think there's other videos of Seymour Cray, but nevertheless,
this is the only talk that people survived. He's a very, very enthusiastic talker, and it was dangerous. It was big
iron.
A lot of voltage.
Sounds like some of the university lectures I barely survived.
I see. So it's just misworded.
Yes.
Thanks for that clarification, Karen. But you have to go see this video, and you have to suffer through the first 9 minutes of it, in which the audio, for whatever reason, is terrible, and then after 9 minutes, it becomes very listenable.
I'm glad you had pointed that out, because I hadn't read that part at first, and I was like, I can't listen to this talk. But it does get dramatically better after a bit.
Yep. And Seymour Cray, not only a genius, not only obviously an incredible computer pioneer in the supercomputer realm, but also I found him from this video to be very personable and a good explainer of these technical concepts. And I also found some interesting stuff, like the fact that they use thick copper as a way to bleed off heat from these incredibly superheated circuits. And we still use copper in heat pipes and that kind of thing today, even in modern laptops. So everything old is new again. But fascinating video for a variety of reasons, including the fact that he's so enthusiastic about the technology that he's talking about. So we'll have a link for it, and I think you should go watch it. And that's all I've got to say about that. And with that, I can turn it right over to Paul, who has a replacement for an LM323K. That sounds like a part that I'm familiar with, but I don't remember what it does.
Yeah, well, and I'm not an expert exactly, but it's a power regulator, I believe. So it's the reason it sort of caught my attention, and I should say I didn't find this on my own. It was Mike Willigal who posted to the Retro Restore list who pointed this out. But it's a part that's used in the interface to the power, and so if you. One of the places that I see this, and the reason it was sort of caught my attention, was the Apple One has one of these in the upper right corner. So if you can picture the Apple One, which I'm sure everyone can, there's a big heatsink up in the upper right corner, and then there's one of these inside of it. And so when people are trying to build these replicas of the actual reproduction Apple ones, you know, they're trying to get all the original parts and so forth, and this is one of the ones. I think this is one that's a little bit hard to get, not as hard to get as those capacitors, but at any rate, and so what we're linking to here is a replacement for the LM323K, which is a linear regulator that is made with modern components, but looks like the old one. So if you look at it from the top, it looks just like the regulator should. And if you look at it underneath, it's got a bunch of, you know, little surface components. It's compatible drop-in replacement. It says it's a 5-volt, 3-amp switch mode voltage regulator. So it's a replacement for a linear regulator, but isn't one.
That's hilarious how they stuck it in a TO3 can, like the old original one. This looks really similar to a voltage regulator that I used to use from time to time building 5-volt power supplies for my TTL projects. It's called an LM309K. Same sort of thing in one of these, what they call a TO3 can with the big metal part on the top and a couple of legs that stick down. And I think the can itself is actually the ground line. So cool. And yeah, this looks, you're right, Paul, if you're looking at it from the top, you wouldn't be able to tell that this wasn't the original component.
Yeah, and so I think this is, and actually, if you're trying to build something like, you know, an Apple One replica, or I think, you know, there's, you know, S100 machines and so forth that would use such a thing. Given the unreliability, apparently, of the original part, this probably would help prolong the life of your replica.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Nice. Well, Carrington, selling the computer revolution, isn't that what we do every 2 weeks?
Yes. I want you all to buy my computer revolution. So this is over at computerhistory.org.
You say you want a revolution?
I do. And I'm not sure. Like, I don't think this is new, but I don't know if we've actually linked to this before. And if not, I don't know why. And maybe we did, and I just didn't pay attention. but I stumbled across this again, and it's awesome. So it's over at computerhistory.org. They've got this amazing, well, they have in their collection a huge number of old vintage computer marketing brochures. And this is a series of webpages, basically like a site within the site that they have set up at computerhistory.org/brochures, where you can view them all. And they've got them, you can search by time, you can search by the company, you can search by type of item it is. You can view really high quality PDFs and also view what they call the full record. So it shows you a picture of what the item is, tells you the date it came out, how many pages were in it, the size, who was the copyright owner, like all these things. So much detail. And it's not new, but for some reason, I think I was unaware of this. And I thought, well, maybe other people are unaware too, because it's a fantastic site with just a ton of vintage computer brochures, some of which I'd seen before, many of which I had never seen before. So I just found myself just getting lost in browsing through it. And it's fun to look at the brochures for the computers that I know, the old Apple computers, that sort of thing. But I found in particular what was fun was look for the ones either that I didn't know that there were brochures for them. Like there's a whole bunch of PDP 11 like resource time sharing brochures, and just it's fun to look at the computers, look at the styles of the clothing people wear in the computer, in the brochures, and that's fun. But a bunch of old Radio Shack ones, SDS computers I never even heard of before, like just a whole bunch of things. So super super fun site. And I just, you know, I had a lovely time falling down the rabbit hole viewing these things. So I thought we would share it with our readers, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
These are great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm stopping the podcast right now.
Aren't these great? So I don't think we've talked about these before, right?
I don't remember talking about this,
okay.
No.
Because I don't know why, because this is not new. It just and I know we've talked about the computerhistory.org site before, but I just never knew that this was part of it.
And you're right. The fashions are amazing.
Totally. The stuff from the 60s and 70s in particular. Really good.
Very cool. All right. Well, I'm going to talk for a second about the Retro Challenge, because they've had their busiest first week ever. And I've been looking at the various blogs of people cooking along with their Retro Challenge, doing all kinds of exciting stuff. I'll just mention a couple here. One is Seth and his ROM monitor for his Homebrew 6502 computer. He's made quite a bit of progress just in this first week, making this thing able to work, you know, with like the old ROM monitor mode like you would find on something like an old Apple or Commodore or something like that, but for a Homebrew computer, which I think is great. And I always wondered how those ROM monitors worked and how they hook themselves into the CPU and where they live and that kind of thing. So, you know, great technical details coming out so far, and I'm sure more to come. Also, when Tez entered the contest, Tezza Stewart from New Zealand, I was thinking, uh-oh, we're all doomed, because this guy just does so much great stuff with retro computing. And yep, he just didn't lose any momentum at all off the starting line. His goal was to debug a RAM card that he had for his Ohio Scientific Challenger computer. And he had to do quite a bit of reverse engineering on this thing, because some of the original documentation just wasn't available or was hard to dig up. But by golly, if he didn't not only get it working, but he's also got a bunch of spare parts. And yeah, I not only don't have an Ohio Scientific, I've never even seen one in person. Not only does he have one, but he's got spare parts for one. I imagine you've got two or three in your garage, right, Paul, with your eBay...
go
ahead.
I was gonna say, I think Vince Briel has made a replica though of this, but not of this necessarily, but of some OSI thing.
That's right, that was his latest project, wasn't it? Was a replica of something from Ohio Scientific. True. Anyway, and myself, I've been banging out the code. I wanted to write three programs for three different computers in three different languages, and I've got one of those matrix of nine things complete. I have Casino Craps complete on the PX8 computer. And one of the things that I'm going to blog about is how hard it is to get a random number seed, because when you're playing these games, obviously you don't want the numbers to be predictable. And all of these computers and languages have some sort of pseudo-random number generator, but the pseudo part means they need a seed. And where do you get that seed from? So, yes, keratin is the seed of all things.
Give me a call and I'll go, Earl, 7. There you go. Feel free to just call me anytime you want one.
The problem with that is, keratin, all of the listeners don't have your number.
They don't?
Well, we could fix that.
Well, let's change the show notes.
Anyhow, if you get a really fast running clock, like something that's running at least, say, line speed, 60 cycles per second or faster, then you can ask the user to do something like press the key to pick a number or something, and they press a key, and at the time they press the key, that can be a really good random number seed. If you take the seconds and the ticks or jiffies or whatever your particular platform calls those smaller units of time, and you do some multiplication and bada bing, you're all randomized and you're good to go. So I wanted to do that with all three of the platforms, and I was able to find good random number seed generators for all of them. So I was doing the happy dance. That's part of my retro project. Before I even put out a lick of code, I had to figure out how to make my numbers random. And I thought, hey, now we're good. So retrochallenge.net, they are off to a running start. And you should go take a look at the blogs, because there's so many people doing so many cool things this time around.
Just to add to the random number thing, I think that the Apple II did the same thing. I think the in the ROM code where it's waiting, the routine that asks for a key press will constantly increment some zero page location, so that whenever you ask for input, it will sort of update the seed with a fairly random number based on how long it took you to actually get around to hitting a key.
Humans are good for entropy. Computers are terrible for entropy, yeah, because they do everything so deterministically. So, yeah, you got to figure out some way to get a human action in the equation there with these old computers, because they can't connect to the internet and get some of the really cool entropy out there, some of which is intentional and other of which is just the internet decaying over.
Ignore all our things we said at the beginning about how to preserve your computers and let one of them just sort of slowly rot. And yes, then it'll give you random who knows what.
Little cosmic ray entropy there. It's great. So, all right. Who's next up here? Michael, are you next with something?
I think I am.
It's the coolest thing ever, by the way.
Yeah, this when this one hit the Twitter waves and the postings, I was gobsmacked. We had in the past discussed the Apple II-styled Raspberry Pi case, which in itself it was a beautiful piece of work. But now, to complete the image, you can get an Apple II, a Monitor II down at the same scale, so it sits right on top of your Raspberry Pi case, just like the real monitor did. It's a 3.5-inch LCD with composite input, so it just plugs straight into the Raspberry Pi. And I suppose it would plug into my Apple IIc. So I'm just sort of having visions of this little monitor sitting on top of my gargantuan Apple II. It even has the tiltable monitor. So a link over to the site so that you can see what Charles has been up to. Play the video, and what starts off looking like a ye olde Apple II with a monitor there, and then the big hand comes down and turns it on. It is a sweet piece of video. It is a great product, and I think I've got to save up my pocket money to buy one.
Me too. I saw this. I couldn't believe how amazing this was. I mean, I was impressed by the Raspberry Pi case because it was cool. But it was a case. You know, it's just like an injection molded thing or whatever. I mean, it's better than I could do, certainly. But this monitor is unbelievably amazing. And every year at Kansas Fest, tons of people show up because you're trying to take small things because people got to fly with them, what have you, these little miniature monitors on their computers. That whole world is dead to me now, and it has to be this. This is the coolest monitor ever.
I just want to see Charles go one step further with his Apple II-styled case. I want that keyboard to be working so that you sit there with a little stylus and press the keys.
It's so good.
That would do it. So, Charles, if you're listening, I want a working keyboard on your Apple II Raspberry Pi case.
And then that really would be Honey, I Shrunk the Computer, wouldn't
it? Oh, yes.
That would do it.
Now, for those of you going to Kansas Fest, on the site at the moment, Charles has, there's like a special. You get 5% off your order if you use a coupon code, which is right on the site. And I suspect he'll be at Kansas Fest, so you'd be able to order it and just pick it up right from there. So
KFest pickup.
So awesome.
And of course, to complete the whole thing, you can actually get an SD card reader styled in a Disk 2 format. So
a little tiny disk. It's all, I'm just so impressed by all of this. It's so amazing.
So I guess I'm going to close this out here on the news and discussion area by talking about some feedback that we've had from folks. We always tell folks we love to hear feedback about the show and things you're interested in the retro world. And as Paul mentioned, it would be encouraging if we actually talked about some of that feedback from time to time. We do get all of the emails. We love reading them. We try to respond to everyone. I know that from time to time we've been delinquent, but honest to goodness, it just warms our heart when we get those emails. And here are a few in no particular order. So Mark wrote in, we had talked on our eBay segment about a paper tape that was from back in the day and labeled Star Trek, with missing the vowels, of course, because you could only have 6-character file names. So STRTRK. Mark bought that. And he's going to image it with the paper tape reader on a Teletype ASR33. That sounds exciting, and I'm really interested to find out what the bits are on that particular paper tape. And I hope also that the paper on that paper tape hasn't denatured to the point where the paper just kind of falls to pieces when it gets imaged. That is a risk with some of those old paper tapes, but, you know, fingers crossed that the fibers are still good. Also, Andy points out, and I think we might have mentioned this before, perhaps, that if you want to buy a new Commodore 64 motherboard, sans a couple of the more popular chips that are on the motherboard, but certainly a functional board, you can do that. And we'll have a link to where you can do that up in the show notes. Also, you can still buy, how do you guys pronounce this? Tatung? T-A-T-U-N-G? Never known how to pronounce that brand. But you can buy some of the old Einstein computers, apparently new in the box, as well as, and we had a few shows back, a link to where you could buy some of the Tano Dragon computers still new in the box. So if you're hankering for some of that new in the box retro goodness, there's a few of these places you can get it, as well as, now these Commodore 64 motherboards, they're a new design. They're not new old stock kind of things. Anyway, we'll have a link to all that up in the show notes. Harmick wanted to let us know about a documentary on YouTube for the IBM 1401. I've actually seen that documentary, and I think you should go out and take a look because, again, this old stuff with the black and white documentaries capturing the details from back in the day when this stuff was new, it's good. And one more thing I'll cover. And so, Michael, you told me that we have already covered this, but I'll mention it again, since apparently we were talking about the difficulties of how do you work with the old Macs, the old lunchbox Macs that don't have a SuperDrive, that have the old 400K or 800K drives, where there is a floppy emulator circuit that you can get from bigmessofwires.com. And I agree with Michael. I think we talked about it before, but we'll have a link again to that.
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. But yeah, we'll put the link in there again. It is a superb piece of hardware. And again, it relates back into our discussion earlier in the show. So it allows you to ease off on using your 400K, 800K drive in your early Toaster Mac by having a SD card image reader that just plugs straight into the floppy drive port of those old Macs. It doesn't know that it's not a floppy drive. It's read-write. It's a superb piece of hardware, reasonably priced. And if you have an early Mac in your collection, strongly recommend that you seriously consider getting one of these units.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. it in the first place, it just lets you get some media to that Mac, which...
Oh, that's the important thing, yeah. As Carrington was saying, when storing it away, you need to have some first boot media. It might be a bit expensive to actually buy one of these and an SD card and drop it into a box and not use it for a decade or two. But at least if you're a early Mac user and collector, it allows you to get a machine up and running, or even take it with you if you're going to do an on-site inspection of something that you're going to pick up. If you can get some power to it, take this, plug it into the floppy drive, power it up, and give the machine a quick run, because it is difficult to for new people, people to the new retro thing with, as you said, the 400K, 800K floppy drives for those Macs. They are a bit of an oddball format, very difficult to write to without another Mac that can actually write to that disk format. But this allows you to just have a SD card with some images on there, and you're off and running.
Very nice. And we did get other feedbacks, and it's possible we'll save some for another future show. But just in general, I do want to thank everybody. We've actually had quite a bit of feedback in the last 2 to 4 weeks. And again, it's just wonderful to hear what you're doing out there in retro computing, in the retro computing universe. That's the way I'll put it.
Aren't you astronauts?
Yes, ma'am. We like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Hi.
Hey.
We're the Pointer Sisters.
We need Stevie's help with our new album.
The Amiga computer. What can it do? Well, what do you want it to do?
I need some more help.
Mr. O'Neill.
Upstairs first door on the left.
Can you hear me? Amiga from Commodore. The computer for the creative mind.
So on to the next segments here in terms of what you can buy. I was thinking, I'm sitting around using my Commodore. I've got my corduroy pants. And
I've got my parachute pants on.
Might be wearing a pair of Vans sneakers, which I understand are back in now.
Oh, I'm going to go clothing shopping before Kansas Fest. Now that you've said this, I totally need Vans.
I got my plaid shirt and my sideburns. And I'm using real floppy disks, and I'm thinking, what's missing? Doggone it, something's missing. I don't have the vibe, and I realize it's that I'm not listening to 80s music. So what can I do about this? Well, I could put on. No, I think there is something that can rescue me. One thing is, I suppose that I could put on a streaming station with 80s music, of which there are plenty, but besides, I'm not going to play that through my boombox. So I'm going to go out and get a pure 80s CD.
Is it available on cassette?
For the exactly right track. For the low, low price of $10.99, I can buy one of these on Amazon. Now, it's not your only choice. There are plenty of choices in this regard, but if you're going to get that whole vibe, you need the music that you were listening to back in these days, because you can think again, you know, how am I going to get my dream girl to go out with me? How am I going to pass my history test? And how am I going to get this Commodore to read this stinking floppy drive within the lifetime of the known universe? Those are questions you should ask yourself while you're listening to the Thompson Twins. I completely think so.
I think you'll have to get another one. I'm looking on here. There's no ELO. There's no Kiss. There's no Queen.
Oh, so you are one of those cool kids.
Many choices. There are many choices on Amazon. This is but one. I just wanted to seed us with the idea of, you know, do you guys ever see the movie Demolition Man?
Of course.
Yes. I still don't know how to work the three shells.
There's a hilarious scene in there where the Sandra Bullock character invites the Sylvester Stallone character over to her apartment, and they walk in, and the place is just 80s memorabilia wall to wall. She says, I've clicked off quite a few credits trying to recreate the perfect 80s experience. And having actually lived through the 80s, I can tell you my walls look nothing like that. It was, you couldn't look any square inch of the room but what was covered with 80s stuff. And I thought that was hilarious. And that's what I want when I'm doing my retro computing. I don't know if my friends will come over anymore if I do that.
But. I'll come over.
Cool.
I'll finally come over.
I'll leave the light on for you, Carrington. So now let's talk about what we all want to buy with some eBay auctions. Paul, I have to say, you are...
I saw this on Twitter. Best choice ever, Paul.
You are definitely our eBay expert. I'm not even worthy to buckle your shoes when it comes to eBay. So tell us what you've got for us this time.
Well, what this is, yeah, I think this did circulate around a little bit earlier, but this is 475 wrapped Moon Patrol games for the Apple II. So if you want, I figured
one for all your friends.
I don't like this one. I'll try another one. No, I don't like it. I think I'll try another one.
If you really like that opening, you know, the opening new software experience, this will last you a year and a third. So
one per day. Carrington loves that experience.
I do. Maybe, well, this is sort of like, you know, like how if your parents catch you smoking, they make you smoke the whole pack. this will cure you.
Carrington, you might even be sick of it by the time.
you like opening that software. We'll make you open all the software.
Not only do you get to take the shrink wrap off the title, you actually get to open up the box of title.
And there are other ones here too. Yes.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a backstory with this, which is basically just that the seller has for quite a while been trying to sell these off one at a time, sometimes six at a time, and I think they just finally decided this is just never going to happen, so gave up and said, all right, here are all of them, you know, bid, but it's $500.
Ooh, 240 copies of Galaxian.
Yeah, there's a couple. Atari Soft massively overproduced these right at the time when nobody wanted to buy them, and I don't think they're in general not regarded as being all that good as games. So at any rate, it's not hard to find wrapped Atari Soft games, particularly for the Apple II. I'm not sure, I haven't seen as many for other platforms, but they're all over the place for the Apple II. But here are 475 of these.
It's basically a buck a box.
Yeah, which actually is a fairly decent price.
Except try to unload them. This person's been selling these since I got back into retro computing. And there's just so many of them. But if you're going to go to Kansas Fest, Paul, you could buy these. And you could just give them out. It'd be awesome. That's what Paul's going to do. I'm announcing it now. Paul's coming to Kansas Fest.
Yeah. Bid before we're done recording.
They don't ship to Canada.
That's our advice. Oh.
Big meanie.
Once again, the Canucks left out.
In the snow.
Well, then, what are you not left out of, Carrington? You've got to have an eBay auction here that you can possibly buy, yes?
Well, I've picked a few. I've done the Paul. See, I've thought, I'll be sneaky. I'll be like Paul. I'll pick a few things. Not realizing Paul can now pick 400 or 500 at once. So I'm going to give up.
See what
this.
I mean? There's no way we match.
I'm giving up this competition, Paul. You win. It's my last time. So, But I found a couple of things that I also am always looking for sealed software because I like the sealed opening thing. And what I liked about these, it's not even particularly great software, but I like them as a pair because they reflect a completely another element of the time back when we were using these vintage computers and other technology that was in favor at the time, including VCRs. And so there's a couple of bits of software on eBay right now for tracking and labeling, you know, it's databases for VCR tapes, labeling your VCR tapes, character generators to put titles at the start of your VCR tape, that sort of thing. And there's two of them have popped up. One's the Video Wizard, and one is the Videotape File System. Video Wizard does a little more, because it'll do the character generator, but both of them will track and create a database of your VCR tapes. And I thought it was wonderful and quaint. I'm like, oh yes, VCR tapes, how awesome. So I'm selecting those as my main pick, because I thought they were fun. And I'm also selecting as alternative picks. One of the a Mosaic in a Box has popped up. And this is the kind of software that I used to rail against back in the day. that would be free software that you would walk into a store and it would be being sold because it was just freely available. So some companies would take them, put them on disk, and say, hey, I'm now charging for it. And I get that maybe if you're being charitable, the thinking at the time was, well, it's for the convenience of people. You don't have to go and download it. And I always thought, no, you're trying to take advantage of people who don't understand this stuff and you're making them pay for it. So it used to really irk me. Now, we're far enough removed from that. It doesn't irk me anymore. I find it, again, it's a neat little reminder of the crappiness that used to exist. So there's Mosaic in a Box is available in case you want to pick up a particularly old, formerly free piece of software for your early Windows PC. And also, when I was looking, I stumbled across an eBay auction for a TI-99/4A. Still in the box. And I thought, oh, how neat. I wonder, was it a good price? I mean, what does a TI-99/4A still in the box go for? So I searched for that in particular. And it turns out there's like 100 of them on eBay. And I guess of all the computers out there, if you want to get collecting and you like your computers in a box, pick the Texas Instruments because nobody who owns those seem to throw out the boxes. It is remarkably simple to get a complete boxed and often new old stock version of the TI-99 for not outrageous prices. So that surprised me. And I was also kind of surprised to learn, because I really don't know the TI, that there were two different versions. I know the TI-99/4A as being that metallic silver-looking plastic computer, but there seems to be a beige version of that as well, which presumably came later. I don't know. But there's tons of boxed versions of both of those. They look like identical models, just made out of different material. And I was just surprised by it. So I just thought I'd let everybody know that if you want to collect computers in boxes, TI-99/4A may be the cheap way to go.
Yeah, I've wound up with a couple of these. Although I really like the, I actually really like the look of the silver and black one, and I really don't like the look of the beige one.
Is the silver and black one? It's been forever since I've even touched one of these, but that's not actually metal, is it? It's the silver plastic, like the old Tandy Coco was.
I believe that's true.
Yeah, because the Coco, when you look at the first model of the Coco, it looks like a massive aluminum thing, must weigh a ton. But then you pick it up, and it weighs like, I was like, oh, this is 6 grams. It's going to float away. It's so light because it's just a big shell of plastic with almost nothing inside it. And I suspect it's the same thing with the TI, but I don't have a distinct memory of it.
It's definitely shinier. I mean, the Coco is duller. It might actually be a thin layer of metal.
Well, Paul, you'll have to buy 400 or 500 of them and find out.
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll be waiting while you do that. In the meantime, Michael, do you have something for us? It looks like you've got an Amstrad.
An Amstrad CPC 464. I always liked the look of these. You know, they're just the splash of color on them, the green, the red keycaps on there. Again, it pops up every now and again, not overly high price. Maybe one day I might even get one of these into my collection. The only real thing that stops me from getting this is that the doesn't come with RF out or composite out. It has a 6-pin DIN socket with the component color in there. So I suppose you could wire something up to try it. There's a lot of information out there on the video connector and format. But really, it's something there. I just like the style of it. It's got the data set over on the right-hand side, your keypad, and just a highlight color for some of the keys in red and in green. So one here. Got three bids on it, $21.50. Not a bad price. Untested, because as the person said, they don't have a monitor that they can plug in. So if you're after a little bit of computer roulette and just want to see what comes up, try something like this. But it's one of those retro style things that it's just got a little something in the aesthetics there that appeals to me.
Mm-hmm. I love those colored keyboards. I think one of my favorite computers from back in the day was the CompuColor. And part of the reason was they also had a very colorful keyboard with a lot of different color codes. It is just really nice looking. So I guess I'll go kind of last here. We also have an eBay item that was sent in from one of the listeners that I think is fascinating. And my item is one of the computer keyboard and computer adapter kits for the Intellivision. Now, as I recall, Mattel got in some level of trouble with this because they brought out the Intellivision, and one of the things they said is that we'll have a computer add-on for this so that you could program it and kids could learn programming in BASIC or something like that. And then they actually had trouble coming out with that particular device, and it was long enough that, again, if I'm remembering properly, I think the Federal Trade Commission got involved in this and said, hey, you guys, you really need to put this out because you said you were going to, and this is kind of fraudulent. So they finally did get this kicked out, and I think these things are fairly rare still.
I never saw one back in the wild back in the day. I've only ever seen just a couple and just online, never got my hands on one.
So here's one that's the complete kit, and they say they had it from 1983. They'd taken it out, used it once, tested it, stuck it back in the box. There it sat for, 30-some-odd years. So, and the starting bid is just one penny, although there's a reserve on this. So it's one of those tricky things that you don't know what the reserve is. The shipping from New York is actually pretty reasonable to me. It's $15. I don't know, Carrington. I don't have visibility up there to see if it ships to Canada. But it does ship to Canada.
At least it does go to Canada for me. Shipping is no charge because we won't send it. That's okay. Transship it. I'm gonna bookmark this one.
I just bookmarked it as well. Let's bid against each other.
It's mine.
Yeah. So you'd actually need an Intellivision to use this, right?
Yeah. It plugs in. It's so funny because this is back in the day when computers are sort of taking off. So you got all the home console systems saying, "Oh, we've got to be computers too," not realizing that no, you're all gonna get destroyed by the NES, which will come and say, "You know what? We play games and it's awesome, and you're all doomed." So they really spent all this time trying to make crappy add-on computers, the Atom, all these things, just make a better game player. I still want this.
Yep.
That was just my way of trying to talk Michael out of bidding.
I think the only time that I've actually seen one is when I was at the Retro Gaming Expo, and they had one there out on display. It wasn't for sale. It was just for display, if I remember right. But so, cool item. And finally, one of our listeners sent us in. Now, this is a retro of a retro, one of those double retro kind of things, because first off, it's an LP record. That in and of itself is retro unless you're one of the diehard audiophiles who insists that vinyl just sounds better. And in that case, it might not be retro to you. But for the rest of us, I don't have a record player anymore, and I wish I did because I've got a few LPs that I'd like to digitize. But it is music that was made on a PDP-8 computer, which is also retro, as we know. So retro of a retro. Unfortunately, it's sold already. It went for what I think is the very reasonable price of $17.50. So somebody, I think, got a steal on this. The title of the record, Unplayed by Human Hands, a private experimental computer shrink, PDP-8. So there you go.
Well, another version is currently on eBay.
Oh, really?
And I think is the seller of the first one MaxT412?
Yes.
Yeah, so that person has listed another one, but with a $60 buy it now. So they're not going to put up with those nonsense low bids anymore.
Well, they may not get it at that rate. But, you know, that's the magic of eBay. You can try what you want to try. Commodore 64, rare, $500, baby. This is a 1975 LP. Oh, is there a make offer, though?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, see, those I don't feel so bad about. Those aren't as outrageous. So, yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome.
All right, so closing discussions. Paul.
Well, I think I sort of feel like I took the whole beginning part as my discussion, so I will leave it at that. I will just continue re-indexing things on my hard drive and trying to get disk images working.
Cool. Carrington.
Kansas Fest. So, yes, I'm starting to get Super excited. Only a few weeks away.
I was going to say, you're not enthused about that or anything,
are
you?
We will be recording the next step. I'm not ready for it. Like, every year I've got all these big plans of stuff I want to do ahead of time, and I've done nothing. I think it's going to be a Kansas Fest where I show up, I hang out with people, and that's what I'm doing. I am running a session, but I think other than that, I'm just basically taking a vacation. I've got nothing prepared.
Hey, Carrington, have they acknowledged your payment?
They've acknowledged that I'm doing a session. So I'm pretty sure. I think a list did get posted of people that are registered. And I was on it, or another Carrington that I will fight shirtless to Star Trek music.
Okay, so the borders haven't been sealed. Okay,
no, good. Not yet. We'll see if I can get in the country. Well, I do have U.S. citizenship as well, so they can't keep me out. So next episode we are recording will be 2 weeks from now, that Sunday, and I will already be en route to Kansas Fest. So I'm not sure if I'll be on the next show, and even if I am, I'm not sure. Because I do the editing, it may be the next episode will be published a couple days late because I will be en route and doing it from Kansas Fest. But I'm very, very excited about that. And also, I want to bring up that I had fallen behind. I kind of forgot about it. I'm every week I post, when I post the episode, I also update the RCR gift guide, which we have over on the rcrpodcast.com site. And I kind of forgot to do it for the last few weeks. So whoopsie. But I have now brought it up to speed. In fact, in the show notes, it says there's 82 gifts list or Yeah, gifts listed, or gifts, as some kids would want to say it. And, but that's actually 83 now, because while we were talking about the feedback, I have already done the posting for this episode's. So the Pure 80s CD is already up there. So there, 83 gifts for everybody to enjoy purchasing from me.
And thank you for maintaining the website.
Oh, it's simple. It's actually super, super easy.
Much appreciate that. And I think our listeners do as well. And Michael, what do you have to close us out?
Well, like you, I'm into the summer challenge for the retro challenge. Definitely a lot of fun. Real life, real world is cramping my programming style, and boy, getting back into AppleSoft programming mode is hard. Even just remembering the command syntaxes and whatnot. But, yep, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I'll have to get my end of week one blog up onto my site. But basically, the bulk of my I.O. side of things is done. So now I'm just getting in to write the long variable name support and a few other bits and pieces, and then part of the any of the other commands. So just had to sit down and figure out the order of which pieces needed to be done in which order. There was just so many things to do. I just actually had to sit back, slow down, and actually figure out the order of doing some of these bits rather than trying to code everything at once.
Given that it's not summer for you, are you allowed to enter a summer challenge? Isn't it illegal?
It's a seasonal thing.
Your deadline was 6 months ago.
Okay. Fine. I'm going
to do it anyway.
That's it. I'm hacking into NORAD and taking you out.
Well, it's about time somebody did.
First rule of retro challenge is don't talk about retro challenge, right? So you can't ask him that question.
Got it, okay.
Yeah. And how's your project coming along, Karen?
It's terrible.
Nicely done.
I'm on Australia time.
I'm going to double what Michael said here, that my son and I have been going through a tutorial series on C# programming. He wants
good
to
language.
Look at being a programmer, and so there was a absolute beginner's guide to C# on Microsoft's Virtual Academy, 20-some episodes, and we went through that, and now we're starting into Windows Phone 8. But then it's such a culture shock to switch off of that and start programming the Atari or the PDP-11, and you're like, wow, where are my object-oriented constructors? I can't find any of that stuff here. Where are my properties and methods? So, yeah, it's a little bit of a mind twist to get back to programming the more modest platforms, but I'm finding it to be very fun. Actually, working out some of the Fortran syntax I thought was some of the most fun, and, acclimating myself to the editor on the PDP-11, which has some strange function key sort of things. So you have to get used to that. But loving it, and I owe the Retro Challenge world a first week post as well, some of the stuff that I've been doing. So Michael and I appear to be kind of in lockstep here. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. And we've got some guests coming up next week from Southern California. So finding some time then is going to be a real challenge. I'm just going to have to give up sleep, I think, which is overrated anyhow. Well, hey, guys, we're over. We're way over. For our listeners, I hope you listen to this on 2x speed. But actually, Carrington is almost unlistenable at 2x speed.
I was going to say, I dare you to listen to any of my podcasts at 2x speed. Bring it.
Overwhelming. It'd be like when the head explodes in Scanners. But that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum, not just podcast, but lots of retro computing stuff. It is a great place with great people. You can follow Retro Computing Roundtable on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and I need to tweet some stuff from time to time. So listeners, you know, tap me on the shoulder, smack me in the head, remind me that the Twitter account should not sit dormant. What is not dormant is our feedback email address, with which we love to get feedback, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, throwbacknetwork.net, where Mr. Flack does all kinds of great things. If you're feeling retro-y, which I have made officially a word, it'll be in the new Oxfords. You can go to throwbacknetwork.net and enjoy yourself. And also, if you would, if you like the show, please write a review on iTunes, because that helps other people find us. And until next time,
Retro Compute!